Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and Craig wants to give special applause today for the charity work being done in our state legislature on behalf of those poor, misfortunate, downtrodden developers.
Yes, they are in need of so much help because they are constantly asking the legislature for help, and the legislature responds like they're working the McDonald's drive-through during a lunch rush. You know, thanks for your order, please pull forward. So I suggested that the Nobel Prize Committee should give them a Nobel Prize for peace for all of their charitable work, up to and including this most recent episode where a state senator named Travis Hudson took a bill that was related to derelict vessels, which everybody agrees are a big problem, and stuck on an amendment that makes it easier and cheaper for developers to move gopher tortoises out of the way of their developments. Mm. It's supposed to be a free market system right now where the free market dictates the price of moving the gophers onto private property. And then the private property owners, that's how they make their money. And he's saying, well, what if we need to make it where they can move it onto public property and that'll drop the price and completely blow up the system. But that'll be easier on the developers.
Easier on the developers, because that's what really matters in Florida. Yeah. And to move the gopher tortoises to public lands, well, any public land that's managed properly is going to be at its carrying capacity for gopher tortoises. So if you move them there, they're either going to die for lack of resources or just fight each other. It's absurd.
Yeah, well, it's all done for the benefit of the developers. So that's why they deserve the Nobel Prize, because apparently the developers need help all the time. They're like the sick kids turning to the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Right. So if they don't, if it's not making it easier to move gopher tortoises, it's making it easier to take out seagrass beds.
Yeah.
It's taking cost off of them for infrastructure like roads and sewers. It is.
Wetland permits. Yeah.
Every single week we could talk on this podcast about how our state legislature and the policies of the state make it easier for developers to destroy this state, kill its animals, and turn a profit off of all of us without having to share any of it.
Yeah.
FloridaPhoenix.com is where you can read Craig's latest article about the gopher tortoise.
Which might have a little sarcasm in it, just a little bit.
Just a little bit, just a little bit. Before we go any further, I want to thank the folks at the Orlando Museum of Art who are hosting me today. I am here in Orlando to preview the Jean-Michel Basquiat exhibition they have upcoming. 25 previously unseen works by Jean-Michel Basquiat out of a private collection. These paintings have never before been seen in public. The Orlando Museum of Art will have them on display through June 30th, 2023. If you are an art lover in even a little bit, way, shape, or form, get yourself to Orlando between now and then for Heroes and Monsters, the exhibition of Jean-Michel Basquiat, Lost Works, recently discovered and on public display for the first time. And now that takes us to our guest, Peggy Bulger, who is the author of Stetson Kennedy, Applied Folklore and Cultural Advocacy. Stetson Kennedy, born in Jacksonville, 1916. He traveled the back roads during the Depression era of Florida, documenting cultural heritage, infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan, an incredibly colorful character who is brought to life by Peggy, who knew him well. She was the state's first folklorist, serving as folk arts coordinator in 1976. From 76 to 89, she held the senior folklore positions at the Florida Folklife Program and created the Florida Folklife Collection. She would go on to work at the Library of Congress. She has lived right near me in Fernandina Beach since 2011, despite us not knowing it until this very day. So, Craig, we've got a great conversation coming here with Peggy.
Stetson Kennedy it just blows my mind that more people don't know about him, but maybe this will help get them acquainted. Let me just say what a fascinating character Stetson Kennedy was. And I'm sorry he's not better known today among the average Floridian. But let me ask you, Peggy, how did you met him? How did you guys meet?
Yeah, this is a great story. So when I was 25 years old with my brand new master's degree in folklore from Western Kentucky University, I was asked to come down to Florida on a one-year grant from the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts, to do a folk arts survey of Florida. I'd never been to Florida in my life. I was born and raised in upstate New York. I'd gone to graduate school in Kentucky, and I thought I knew the South because I was in Kentucky. And so I said yes, sight unseen. I came down to Florida. And I was based in White Springs, Florida, on the Snake River, a town of 800 people, basically 400 white, 400 black, deep South culture. Yes. But my job was to travel all around the state to document folk art, folk story, recipes, you name it. And I was naive enough to think that I could do that in a year. it was, but I had died and gone to heaven. It was a great job. So I did realize, though, that the very first attempt that the federal government had ever tried to really document culture and to really know what people were all about was during the Works Progress Administration, when we had the Federal Writers Project, where we put, you know, writers were also out of work. And they used that term very loosely because you had everything from Pulitzer Prize winning authors being hired at the same rate, $26.50 a week. They would be hired along with, you know, out of work librarians or, you know,
typists.
Anybody who was literate. So I went to the University of Florida, where most of the materials from the Florida Writers Project, every state had a state office. And I was reading all this wonderful stuff, of course, Zora Neale Hurston stuff, but I kept running across Stetson Kennedy. Stetson Kennedy, he did all this work. And at the time, a very famous folklorist for Florida, Alton Morris, was at the university. And I was talking to him and I said, you know, I am reading all this stuff about Stetson Kennedy and all that he did. And I said, it's really too bad, you know, he's dead. And he goes, he's not dead. He's alive and well and lives in Jacksonville. I said, you've got to be kidding. So, you know, but think about it. I'm 25 years old. These are materials that were being collected in the 1930s.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, he's got to be dead, you know. Yeah. And so I called him up. I found his number. I called him up and asked if I could come visit him. So I went over and I realized now that he was only 60 years old when I met him.
Yeah, the spring chicken. I know,
because he got his job with the Florida Writers Project when he was like 21 years old.
Yeah.
So anyway, make a long story short, I went over to his land that he had inherited. He called it Beloosahatchee, which is a word that Zora Neale Hurston told him about, which is kind of a African-American term for paradise. And he lived on a little pond with cypress trees and great blue heron as a pet who would come onto his porch in an A-frame. You know, his life, I wanted to talk to him about what it was like in the 1930s in Florida and collecting all of this wonderful folklore and culture at the time.
Being the first one to do this stuff.
It really was a new concept. There was no such thing as oral history. And folklorists had been around a long time, but a lot of times they were what we would call armchair folklorists. Mm-hmm. They would be studying like the Grimm brothers from decades ago and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this was the first time that people went out to really get the real stories from people. And thank God they did, because, you know, it was during that time that we got the ex-slave narratives. Right. And those are all at the Library of Congress, of course. And they're so powerful in their own words, what it was like to live in bondage. It's amazing. Most of this stuff is all digitized and up online. So I would encourage anybody, if you're interested in really the history of any state and slavery or whatever, get into those Federal Writers Project materials that are all up online.
And that, so, that project, the slave narrative started in Florida, right? If I remember
yes.
right. Yeah.
Yes. And there's just some wonderful material there. Most of the narratives are written, mm-hmm. although there are about, it's about 30 hours of audio that was recorded. Wow. And just to hear their voices and the matter of fact way that they would talk about being brutalized, it just blows your mind.
But so Stetson Kennedy, he was born in Jacksonville and sort of grew up in that.
Yes.
Post-Reconstruction era of casual white supremacy, yeah. I guess you'd call it.
Well, Stetson was born into Georgia and Florida aristocracy, really. Stetson came from a fairly wealthy family in Jacksonville, and he was born on October 5th, 1916. He grew up in Riverside, a fairly wealthy neighborhood in Jacksonville, in a beautiful house. He had five siblings. He, but the family names in his family are Woodward, Sanford, Lanier, Wallace, Stetson, and Kennedy. And of course, his most famous ancestor would have been his great uncle, John B. Stetson, who of hat
the
fan.
Hat, yeah. Right.
Yes, but also he came down, he was an industrialist, northern hat manufacturer, came down to DeLand, Florida in the 1880s and started Stetson University here. And anyway, Stetson grew up a fairly privileged childhood. They had a black maid that Stetson, right from the beginning, just took to, and really, it was almost like he was born to be a folklorist. He started interviewing the black maid all the time. And then when he was just a young boy, probably about 12 years old, he would help. His father had a furniture business in downtown Jacksonville, and he sold furniture to both poor white and poor black customers for a dollar down and a dollar a week for, you know, your furniture.
Yeah.
And Stetson's job was to go collect that dollar a week. And so he would not only collect the dollar a week, but he would sit and talk to people. And that was where he really started, you know, collecting folk idiom, collecting stories. And also, it opened his eyes to the disparity that continues to this day.
Yeah. Right. White privilege, basically. Yeah. Yeah.
What a remarkable character trait, though, for a kid.
Yes.
We're talking about it. Imagine yourself 10 years old, just going, talking to old people about the good old days. And these were not good old days for the people he was talking to. But imagine you just put yourself in his shoes as a 10-year-old being interested in anything an old person has to say.
Well, he was very unusual. He was the black sheep of his family. They never could understand what the heck he was doing, but I think he was just ahead of his time, because if you're familiar with The Bitter Southerner, Stetson was the original practice radical empathy. And so he not only became very interested in, you know, later in life, he was very active in the civil rights movement and in the labor unions. He worked for the Henry Wallace campaign. He knew everybody who was, there was a whole group of really Southern white liberal, or some people would say radicals, who really were just dedicating their life to trying to make life better in the South. And he definitely considered himself to be a Southerner, but I asked him one time, you know, how did you get to be a folklorist? He says, I'm not a folklorist. I'm a poor focused. And it was true. He always considered himself to be an activist first and then a writer folklorist second. That was how he could be more effective as an activist, was by writing and by collecting people's stories and telling their stories.
Yeah, I was fascinated that he took a writing course from Marjorie Rawlings.
Amazing.
That just blew my mind, yeah.
It's a small world. But and so I So when I started talking to him, I really was interested. I only knew about his life as a, you know, as the Federal Writers Project. Mm-hmm. At a very young age, he had come to the attention of Corita Doggett Course, who was the head of the Florida Writers Project. And the main office was in Jacksonville. And at the time, Stetson had dropped out of the University of Florida, where he had also been an activist. He started all kinds of groups, you know, political groups in the university. He dropped out. And as he said, he invented independent study. He hitchhiked down to Key West and then had all of his books shipped there. And he started collecting. And you know, he had no money because by this time his family was, they gave him enough to live on, but they were really,
they cut him off.
They couldn't understand what the heck he was doing, dropping out of college and all that. But at the time, in the 1930s, Key West was under federal control because it was absolutely bankrupt. There was no money whatsoever. So the federal government had come in and they were kind of using Key West as a...
It's like a lab.
Test to see if they could make it into a tourist attraction, which it wasn't. So they put all these people... they gave them all jobs in what would eventually turn into the Civilian Conservation Corps, but they would give them jobs to, for instance, Stetson's first job down there was to rake seaweed off the beaches so that the beaches would be pretty for people who came down to be, tourists. And when he was doing that, though, he was again collecting all this, all these stories. The people who are with him. And he has this one great story about talking with a, you know, a Cuban man who was also raking the seaweed. And it came lunchtime and the guy stopped raking the seaweed and he took out a big loaf of Cuban bread and he cut it down the middle and he held it up to the air over the ocean, slapped it together and started eating. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, I made a sea breeze sandwich."
Oh my gosh.
And Stetson said, which probably gave it a little bit of a fishy taste. So.
Just an extraordinary character. And as Craig was saying, someone a lot of people don't know about, and I'll put myself in that category. When Craig sent me the topic rundown, I'm like, Stetson Kennedy, okay, who is this? And then I read LA Times obituary, Washington Post obituary, New York Times obituary, and saw that he took a writing class from Marjorie Kinnan Rawlings, and he worked with Zora Neale Hurston, and he broke up the Klan, and Woody Guthrie wrote a song about him, and he's from Jacksonville, and I'm from an hour away in Fernandina Beach. I'm like, how have I never heard of? The whole thing blew my mind. When was he like lost? I mean, this person should be in statues and on the name of schools. I mean, why don't we know Stetson Kennedy largely across this state?
Well, that's a good question. But when I started, like I said, when I started talking to him about his work with the WPA, I had no idea that he had infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan. And I had no idea he went behind the Iron Curtain when it was illegal to do so and wrote for TASS, and that he was in Hungary during the Hungarian Revolution and escaped to Paris and became friends with Jean-Paul Sartre. He was friends with Desmond Tutu.
It goes on and on. I mean, it's astonishing the life this person led.
He's Florida Zelig.
I know. And so I ended up actually going and talking with Stetson, you know, maybe once a week for years. And we became fast friends, and we're fast friends until he died. And he died right before his 95th birthday. But I still remember my favorite time with him was when Barack Obama had his inauguration, and we went to some parties, and I have never seen Stetson so happy that he finally lived to see a African-American president. And I am so glad he died before
before what came after.
We are today.
Now, what was it like for him traveling with Zora Neale Hurston while they were both working for the WPA? That must have been pretty amazing.
This is an amazing story. So Stetson was down in Key West, and he had been hired by Carita Course to do junior interview work at $26.50 a week. And he was collecting all this stuff and sending all this folklore up to the Jacksonville office. He came to the attention of Dr. Benjamin Botkin, who was the head of the folklore social ethnic units for Washington, D.C., for the Federal Writers Project. And Botkin looked at what Stetson was sending in, and he told Carita Course, he says, listen, you've got to get this guy to be the head of your folklore, oral history, and social ethnic unit in Florida. And so at the age of 22, Stetson became in charge of that unit. Now, there were two units because there was a white unit and there was the Negro unit.
Mm-hmm. And so, as they called it then. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so he went up to Jacksonville, which was where the main office was. He was working with Carita Course, and Carita took the whole unit, everybody in the office together, and called them together and said, we have hired a woman named Zora Neale Hurston, who's a Pulitzer Prize winning author. Zora had just finished studying with Franz Boas up at Columbia University. She was an anthropologist, and she was just, as you know, an amazing writer and folklorist. And she's coming down, and she's going to work with the Negro unit. And Stetson, you're her boss. And so Stetson is like, oh my.
And I'm so 22 and I'm supervising a Pulitzer winner. Nice.
The other thing was, Carita Course says, now, Zora has taken on quite a few eccentricities. She smokes in front of white people. And, you know, the other. And so I said to Stetson, I said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, Zora came and Zora smoked and we made allowances. but he did say there was no way you could supervise Zora Neale Hurston. She was a force of nature herself, and she knew what she was doing. And she'd go away for 2 or 3 weeks down to South Florida. She'd go to Eatonville, her town, and then she'd go even further. And she'd just, you know, he'd call her up maybe every 3 weeks and say, Zora, what have you got? And she would send in these enormous manuscripts of stuff that she had collected that was just wonderful. So a lot of that, of course, went into her books, you know, Their Eyes Were Watching God and Mules and Men and just amazing. But they were good friends. It was very hard, though, because they were trying to do field work in Florida. It was Stetson Kennedy and sometimes Alan Lomax, sometimes Robert Cook, who was a photographer, and Zora. And to have a black woman and white men in the same car was very dangerous. And so they really had to watch what they were doing. And they collected amazing stuff in the turpentine camps of North Florida, in the down in Pahokee and Belleglade, in the sugarcane industries. You know, Zora, of course, being fearless, she would go into these juke joints and collect songs, like really racy songs, you know. obscene songs, and we have them all at the Library of Congress. And hear them. Not ready for prime time.
Yeah, we actually had an episode on Zora Neale Hurston, if people want to go back through the archives, and we did play some of those songs about the women from Tampa. You can listen to snippets of those, and there is a link in that episode to hear the full renditions from the archive. So if anyone is interested in hearing those songs or more about the remarkable Zora Neale Hurston, there was an episode in the archives where they can hear all of that. But yes, do continue, Peggy.
Yeah. Well, and ironically, you know, what comes around goes around. You know, I ended up from 99 until I retired, I was the director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, which was where those materials are housed. All of those recordings were housed. Yeah. So it was like coming back home.
What a tremendous gift for Florida to have such two talented individuals sharing those stories at a time. Again, this was long before I-95 and hotel rooms and air conditioning, and it's easy to get around. I mean, what they went through in that Depression era, period to gather this material is extraordinary.
Right. Yeah. Did his work with the WPA, is that what led him to decide that he was going to infiltrate the Klan?
Oh, so this is how that happened. As you know, the Works Progress Administration was abruptly shut down with the entry of World War, the United States into mm-hmm. World War II.
Right.
And so they had to shut down everything. It was very chaotic. They had to, pack everything up and hope that things got where they needed to be. And thank God they did. But Stetson tried to join the Army. And it turns out that he had, I don't know what it was. It wasn't bone spurs, but it was something.
Some sort of back problem. Yeah.
Back. Yeah. Yeah. And he couldn't join. And so he decided, he said, to fight fascism at home. And he knew he had an uncle. John Perkins, who actually, he was dead, but he had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan, which was, the Klan was very, very prevalent in the 1920s and 30s, totally out. And so he decided to go up to Atlanta. He joined the Stone Mountain Clavern of the Ku Klux Klan under the name John Perkins. He went undercover and basically lived a double life for the next 5 years of his life. He joined more than 20 hate groups in the Atlanta area, like the Columbian Brown Shirts, and all under the name of John Perkins. He was doing three things. He was working with Daniel Duke, who was a prosecutor in Atlanta, trying to prosecute some of the hate crimes in which they were actually prosecuting Eugene Talmadge, who was the governor, who was also a Klan member.
Yikes.
He was also good friends with Drew Pearson, the journalist who had a show called Merry-Go-Round. And he, so Stetson.
Oh, the column, his syndicated column. Yeah.
Syndicated column. Yes. And he also was in touch with the people with the Superman radio program. So Stetson would go to the Clavern meetings, and everybody's wearing their hoods and everything. And he got them on their folklore. He would publicize their secret passwords, which would change every week. He would, publicize their secret handshakes and, hand salutes, like if you met a Klan member on the street, there's certain hand salutes that you would know that that's a like-minded person. And
like
so
throwing a gang sign. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very interesting. And basically he worked very hard, but he got evidence so that in Georgia, they got the Klan's charter to be revoked because they were chartered as a educational cultural organization.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. And so they really proved that they were conspiring to deny people their civil rights. And so,
I want to come back to that point about how he got that information. But tell us about the Superman connection, because I can picture people going, Superman, what's that got to do with it?
Well,
this is a great story. This is a great story.
Yeah. So the producers of the Superman radio show had a whole series that was about Superman battling the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. And it was like
amazing.
Kids were learning this. So you talk about critical race theory now, where people are upset that somebody should hear about the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Stetson was giving them information, inside information about what actually happens in a Klan meeting and everything. And that kind of information was used in the radio show. And so that was very controversial, obviously. And he, in 1946,
it must have freaked out the Klansmen hearing their secret stuff popping up on national radio programs.
They were after him. I mean, they didn't know who it was, but they were really,
they knew they had a mole.
I said, you know, back then you could do this because Klansmen would wear hoods to hide their identity. Now they would just go be proud.
Yeah.
Of who the
Proud
they
Boys,
are, you know? Yeah. Yeah, I'm just like, yeah, this wouldn't work in today's, you know, in the way things are today. But anyway, back then he decided that he really needed to come out from cover, and he went to Washington, D.C. in his full Klan regalia with his briefcase and his Klan suit. Wow. And he went to the House Un-American Activities Committee with Martin Dees. And he wanted to give testimony on the fact that the Klan was a terrorist organization. Well, Martin Dees threw him out of the office and told him that the Klan was just as American as apple pie.
Yeah. Oh, man. But before we move on, I want to ask you about how he got the information for the charter, about the Klan's charter. It involved dumpster diving or something like that, right?
Yes. Yes. He was very wily, but he actually knew, you know, where to go to get these things. And then he was very, very sneaky about getting it around. Well, thank God, because, I mean, his life was in danger.
Right.
And for 5 years, he was really, and he was working, like I said, with Daniel Duke, who was this prosecutor who, you know, with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. So they really couldn't protect him. You know, he was always a wild card. He never would do what he was supposed to do. He, you know, he just did what he did. So when he came out from undercover, his life was in danger. His land at Beloothahatchee was set on fire by local Klansmen. They ransacked his house. He had death threats every day. And so what he decided to do, he decided to lay low for a while. And this was in 1952. There was a commission from the United Nations Commission that was looking into worldwide forced labor and slavery. And they had come to the conclusion that there was no forced labor and slavery in the United States. And so Stetson had all of these recordings that he and Zora had done in the turpentine camps and in the vegetable fields down in South Florida, where people were literally, they were kept in the woods and they could not leave. They would be killed if they left. Mm. And so he told them that he had these recordings and he would like to testify. So they said, well, if you can get over here, we'll hear you. So he took everything he had. He had about $7 to his name after he got his one-way plane ticket to Geneva. And he testified and they heard him. And then he decided, you know, he was still a very young man. He decided to... He thought he would go behind the Iron Curtain to see if communism was the answer. He really was a pie in the sky kind of thinker. He thought, well, you know, they talked a good game. Mm-hmm. And he thought that maybe people would not be discriminated against behind the Iron Curtain. So he was in West Berlin and he got on the subway. And at a certain point where West Berlin goes into East Berlin, you're supposed to get off the subway if you don't have, you know, the proper paperwork. Well, he just stayed on the subway and he gets behind the Iron Curtain. They don't know what to do with him because he's he wants to be there, but they, you know, he has no paperwork and whatever. To make a long story short, he was basically under house arrest for a while in Germany. And then he went over to Hungary and some of the what would later become the SSRs. He was writing for TASS. He was always a writer. And, that, you know, I'm sure they thought that was great. Here's a United States citizen writing for TASS.
Yeah.
And but he became very disillusioned because he found out that the Roma people, the gypsies, were treated worse than the blacks in the South, that, you know, everybody had their prejudices. So he was very disillusioned. But he was in Hungary during when the Hungarian Revolution broke out. And he, by this time, he was on his third wife. I don't know.
Yeah,
about
we wanted to talk about that. He had seven.
He had seven wives. He had seven wives altogether. And I think he had two at once, but.
Oh, my.
Water under the bridge.
Yeah, I think the statute of limitations is right.
But anyway, he had a Hungarian wife, and they escaped to Paris. And when he got to Paris, of course, his passport was totally invalidated. And the Paris police didn't know what to do with him because he had no passport. He was like a man without a country. And he became very close to a lot of the expat community. Richard Wright became a good friend. He was living there. He was under basically house arrest in Paris. Like, they would let him go in the daytime, but the gendarmes would tell him to come back to the jail to sleep at night. And he did that for over a year. You know, but he loved it. He loved it.
So he hotel bill.
Yeah, he was gathering all kinds of information. And but finally, he did need to get back home. And in 1960, it was Jean-Paul Sartre that pulled some strings and got him a passport so he could come home.
Unbelievable.
Home to Jacksonville.
Yeah, the book about his infiltration of the Ku Klux Klan is I Rode with the Ku Klux Klan, published in 1954. It was later republished, I believe, in 1990 or somewhere around then. Yeah. And then The Jim Crow Guide to the USA in 1959 was something of a sequel to an incredibly prominent, now that I look back in history, there's so much written, you know, those books are kind of lost to history now, but at the time they were a big deal.
They were totally a big deal. And, you know, that predated the Green Book, you know, but it was a tongue-in-cheek travel book about if you're a person of color, what you could see and do in the South. And it made no bones about the fact that there were certain places you don't want to go, you know, you can't go. And so back then, even the ocean was segregated. It was crazy. Yeah. So Stetson, actually, when he came back, he continued working very strongly with civil rights, but he also had become great friends. Before he had left for Geneva, he became great friends with Woody Guthrie. Woody Guthrie had read Stetson's first book, which is called Palmetto Country. It's still evergreen. And if you haven't read it, you need to read it because it's really a wonderful book. But what it was that when he was with the WPA, with the Florida Writers Project, they were, of course, collecting material to write the Florida guidebook, which every state was going to have a guidebook. But they didn't want anything negative in it. They wanted Moonlight and Magnolias and, it's so wonderful, Sunshine State. Well, he was collecting things about pellagra and, you know, ringworm and poverty and racism. And he took a lot of the stuff that he couldn't put in the guidebook, and he created Palmetto Country, which was a more realistic look at what Florida was like back then.
When Woody Guthrie liked it, I take it.
Woody Guthrie loved it and wrote him a wonderful, like, 5-page letter about how, you know, there's nobody who's written better about, you know, state and everything. So Woody ended up coming to visit Stetson and staying at Beloothahatchee. By this time, this was, you know, right about 1950-51. And Woody was already starting to exhibit some symptoms of what we now know was Huntington's chorea. But of course, he wasn't diagnosed at the time. But he was really an unusual, eccentric character at the time. He and his girlfriend, Anike, came and stayed on Stetson's land. And when Stetson went over to Geneva, Woody and his girlfriend were staying on the land. And one of the things that happened, he burned his hand very badly, and he had to go into Jacksonville to St. Vincent's Catholic Hospital to be treated. And they have this very funny, in the book that I wrote about Stetson, they have this very funny patient intake form about Woody Guthrie. Okay, on June 10th, Woody, went and he's in St. Vincent's Catholic Hospital. The admission slip told a tale. This is the admission slip. Patient says he plays stringed instruments. The patient is a peculiar. He wears shaggy hair and beard, which he says is to keep mosquitoes away. This couple, and he's talking about Woody and his girlfriend, are drifters. Came down here several months ago. The patient is supposed to be a musician, folk music. He has quite a history. No, it's the intake form. Wow. But Woody and Stetson became great friends. And of course, Stetson had met Woody up in New York City at Alan Lomax's house. He knew Pete Seeger really well. All of these progressive folks who were either folklorists or folk music aficionados, they knew each other and they worked together. But Stetson also was very prominent in like the Southern Leadership Conference. He was very instrumental, like with Clifford and Virginia Durr, who were from Alabama, who really were the ones who helped with the bus boycott. And with Clifford Durr was the very first head of the FCC. He was he became the head of the FCC under Franklin Roosevelt. And so they all knew each other. There were a group of very progressive Southerners. One couple that Stetson knew really well was Zilphia and Miles Horton, who started the Highlander Center. And the Highlander Center first was in Tennessee, which is where the University of the South is right now, but then it moved to a little bit further over towards Knoxville. But it was a very progressive retreat center, and it was the only place in the South where they had integrated workshops and things where blacks and whites were together. And it said that Zilphia Horton, who is a musician, was the very first person to actually take We Shall Overcome and use it politically. And they would train people there. And Stetson was one of the people to come, be a teacher and also train with them. So he was very well connected during that 1930s time. And then, of course, he went overseas and kind of had to reestablish himself when he came back, but he did. He has letters from Martin Luther King, who came to St. Augustine, and
right.
Stetson, who was friends with everyone who really was working on behalf of equal rights.
And Woody Guthrie had a really productive time at Stetson's place too, right?
Yes. So when
Woody, in spite of the fire, burning his hand.
When Woody stayed at Beloothahatchee, which was for a few years, he wrote 88 songs.
Oh my gosh.
And he also finished the manuscript for Seeds of Man while he was there. And so Beloothahatchee became a designated Florida literary landmark in 2003 by the Friends of Libraries USA. This is, because of Woody Guthrie's creativity while he was there. Then it became a second literary landmark for Stetson's work in 2014. One of the things that Woody did, he wrote several songs for Stetson because Stetson was in a campaign. He was running for Florida State Senate on a colorblind write-in candidate. He didn't win.
Shocking.
Yeah.
He ran for governor too, didn't he?
No, it was the Senate. He didn't.
Oh, was it? Okay.
But he was running against George Smathers, who was a proud member of what we still know as the Pork Chop Gang. He didn't stand a chance. But I love some of the songs that Woody wrote for Stetson. And one of those actually was picked up by Billy Bragg and Wilco. and put on Billy Bragg's album, and it's called Stetson Kennedy. He's that man. I said, whoa.
Amazing.
You know, it is amazing that he isn't more well known, but he
is Beluthahatchee still there? Is that something people can visit?
Yes. Yes. And it's wonderful. Beluthahatchee, when Stetson died, St. John's County acquired the land, and it became and is an educational center. They've restored Stetson's little A-frame house that he had there. And there's another house there that's used for bigger meetings. They hold workshops and they have music sessions on Sundays. It's just a great little place for people to come and, you know, have a place that's both creative, but also is really got a, how should I say it? It's one of those places, I think, where you could come if you were both Republican or Democrat and know that while you're there, you're going to listen. You're not going to put the other person in a trash can because they don't believe in what you believe. So that's what they're trying to do. And Stetson was very happy to have that be done, you know, because that near the end of his life, he knew that the work will never be done, you know, it's just going to keep going on.
It pains me to bring this up, but I think we have to, because some people, the most recent stories about Stetson right before he died was the Freakonomics scandal, I guess is a way to refer to it, which is kind of a mess.
I will tell you, the Freakonomics guy, what's his name? I block it out of my mind. He had determined that when Stetson wrote I Rode with the Ku Klux Klan, that he wrote it in the style of like
30s pulp fiction, basically.
Yes. And because he wanted it to be read by, you know, the people. He didn't, it was not an academic book. It didn't have footnotes. It didn't have, it was written as a memoir. Somehow, well, Stephen
Dubner and Stephen Levitt are the
Freakonomics. Yeah, there's two guys.
He came down and talked to me about, well, I think Stetson has lied here. And I said, what are you talking about? And he's saying, well, he said, da-da-da-da. I said, he was writing his memoir. It was like he was making it, yeah, kind of sensational, but he did that. He infiltrated the Klan. He did that. And I, you know, nothing I could do. It was in my own feeling, I think that Stephen Dubner was just wanting to make more money, because the more controversy you have, and so he made a big deal of it. Well, it came out in the New York Times, and they asked me, and I wrote a rebuttal in the New York Times about that this was, and not only did I write a rebuttal, but it was Desmond Tutu wrote a.
Wow.
Yes. It griped me so much that here's this man in his 90s who's worked all of his life for other people, and nothing of this was to make money for him. And then here comes this young, cocky, you know, University of Chicago economist. He didn't seem to give a care about what he did for, you know.
At the very least, it seems more like a Lost in Translation or Forest for the Trees situation. Right. It didn't matter.
It's over.
Yeah, right.
It really diminishes what Stetson was all about.
Well, what doesn't diminish what he was all about, and what was a real chilling phrase that he wrote 70 years ago in describing the Ku Klux Klan as, quote, homegrown racial terrorists. Boy, if that doesn't hit the bullseye in 2022, decade after his death, over 100 years after he was born, reading that, it is a chilling reminder of how far we haven't come in Florida, in America, in racial equality, but how that continues despite, like you mentioned, critical race theory and people wanting to bury that and pretend that there's some patriotism involved in storming the Capitol with a weapon to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. That's legitimate political thought.
It's legitimate political discourse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
asinine. And here was, you know, Stetson Kennedy in the 50s talking about hate groups working to prevent equality, diminish voting rights, diminish economic equality, and terming them homegrown racial terrorists, a term that is on the front page of our headlines. So I thought that was astonishing echoes through history.
Right. He worked from the very beginning with the Southern Poverty Law Center and with other groups that were really monitoring hate groups, because he recognized the fact that, you know, many of the law enforcement and, you know, officers in Florida were part of the Klan, many of the politicians, and some of these things still go on today.
Yeah.
It blows my mind that we're still. Well,
just recently, the AP had a big expose about how many prison guards in Florida are Klan members. You know?
Oh, yes. And I can't even imagine. And you know, we can't forget that, you know, especially back then in the 1940s and 50s, lynchings in Florida were epidemic. I mean, they were, and
I remember reading Florida actually was first in the South in the number of lynchings.
Right, right. And we tend to think like, oh, Mississippi or George. No, Florida.
Well, yeah, and it was, I was reading Craig's book, Oh, Florida, again, and it was the acid attack at the St. Augustine Motor Lodge that finally got the Senate off its ass and stopped filibustering to sign the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So again, not Mississippi, not Alabama. You talk about the prevalence of the Klan. In 2022, you know, in contemporary times, people think of Florida, South Beach, multicultural, Latin, Caribbean, Disney, Epcot.
Modern version of Moonlight and Magnolias. Yeah.
No.
But, I mean, you know, it has always been that way. Florida is so complex. And, you know, depending on what you're looking for, you know, it can be the best times and the worst times. And I
absolutely
think that, Florida's got to face up. I mean, Florida in 2022 scares me.
Agreed. And you mentioned that you are glad that Stetson Kennedy died before Trump was elected. It's hard not to imagine, if he were here today, him being heartbroken and wondering where all his hard work went to when everywhere you turn is an attempt to divide the races, keep Black people down, prohibit this history from being told and learned from as we drive at 100 miles an hour off another cliff, heading straight towards these problems that were life and death 70 years ago.
Well, and I think, you know, it is really telling that here in Florida, you know, we're talking about banning books again. We're talking about what I would hate to be a public school teacher right now, because all of a sudden, you are being cast as an evil influence, that the parents can go ahead and sue you for saying something.
For making their kids feel uncomfortable. Yeah.
That's right.
So given all of that, what is Stetson Kennedy's legacy to us? What take away from his life and his work that we can still hold to, or how has he inspired people?
Well, I think he continues to inspire people. There are young people who come to Beloothahatchee's to learn about peaceful demonstrations, about how to make your voice heard, how to register people to vote. You know, those things are going on in a lot of different places, but I think that's one place that at Beloothahatchee where that's still happening here in Florida. There's another organization that I think Stetson would definitely probably be involved with if he was alive, is Braver Angels, which is a group that's national, actually, but it's a group that gets people on both sides of the aisle and, you know, one-on-one to talk to each other and listen with a moderator, one person at a time, almost, because you get to where you have a whole party of people who will just place everybody who doesn't agree with you in, you know, the trash can. And so I think that you know, we'll see. I feel so discouraged at times. You know, I'm 72 and, you know, I marched, you know, in 1968, you know, against the Vietnam War. And, you know, just we thought we were making a difference, but I think it's cyclical and you can see it is happening right now. It's happening more than ever, you know, where you have, you go from Barack Obama to Donald Trump to Joe Biden. Next, who could be next? You know, God forbid. I don't know.
We'll see.
Peggy Bulger has been our guest. What a fascinating conversation. We could go on and on and on. We try and rein these into an hour, and that'll be, it was tough to turn this conversation off because it was so great. Links to everything.
Stetson's such a fascinating character. Oh, yeah.
Links to everything we've discussed are in the show notes if you want to look for more. Peggy, thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Let me tell you how I learned about Stetson Kennedy. Sure. This is very embarrassing to me. I should know this, but I had never heard of him. And my first book came out, Paving Paradise. Matt Waite and I wrote that based on a series of newspaper stories we'd done about the loss of wetlands in Florida. And we heard from the Florida Historical Society that the book had won the Stetson Kennedy Award. And we were like, great, who's Stetson Kennedy? And so, you know, we went and started researching that. And I read Palmetto Country and was just blown away. I was like, oh, my God, who is this guy? Awesome. So
and I think, you know, one of the things we're trying to do with this podcast is create a mosaic of Florida people, history, wildlife, natural places. And to me, this is a really important piece of that mosaic, which connects to Zora Neale Hurston, which connects to Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings, which connects to the Cuban sandwich, as Peggy mentioned, in American
WPA
Beaches.
Guide to Florida that we talked about with Kathy Silvestri. Yeah.
So many. This is one of those puzzle pieces that really brings a lot of the other ones together. Clearly a critical figure from Florida's history that, and again, until we did this episode, and I live on Amelia Island, not a half mile from where Peggy lives. We're both there in Fernandina Beach. He's in Jacksonville right there. I'd never heard of him.
Yeah.
What does that say?
You're right. Maybe we should put up some statues. Since apparently that's the only way people know history. Statues.
Welcome to Florida.
Yeah.